out there, rock and rollers. Welcome to episode number 131 of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast. Brought to you by me, your host, Mac B. the Wolf. And I will be joined, as always, by my partner in crime and former college roommate, Gary Action Jackson. He'll be coming to you from the East Coast of the United States of America. And we want to thank everybody who tuned in last week to episode 130 on our interview with Scott Holliday from Rival Sons. That was a hell of a fun interview. Scott's a great guy, a big talent, talking about their new album, Dark Fighter, which is out June 2nd. I tell you guys, once I heard a preview of Dark Fighter, I'm like, this is awesome. This is one of the best new rock records I've heard in years. I gotta talk to someone who made it. We had the opportunity to talk to Scott about it, and he was a super guy. He loves a lot of the same music that we do. He's good at doing his interviews. He was on the road between gigs in a hotel room. He still made time for us. It was a lot of fun, and we got a lot of downloads. It was incredibly popular for us, and we really appreciate it. We appreciate Scott, and we appreciate Talita from his PR team, and we appreciate everybody out there who listened to it and downloaded it. And if you haven't, I really, really highly recommend you listen to it, and definitely go out by June 2nd and get Dark Fighter. It's a killer hard rock album. And there's going to be a second, kind of a part two, called Lightbringer coming out this fall. We talk about that during the interview that we're also super duper excited about. Now this week, we've got another round of interviews from some killer rock and rollers with a new album coming out that we think you ought to hear. Okay, but it's not a new necessarily band. It's not an old necessarily band. It's a little bit of both here. Okay, the Cosmic American Derelicts have been going for about a quarter of a century, New Jersey-based band who play, you know, all around, including in England. They do a little country, they do folk, they do blues, they do some psychedelic stuff. A lot of it very guitar-driven, but they've got some great piano in there as well. And they've hooked up with the legendary Terry Reid. And for those who listen to our show or not, you know that Terry Reid has been around a long time. He toured with the Stones in the 60s. His first gig in New York City was at Madison Square Garden opening for Cream when he was a teenager. Are you kidding me? This guy has got some killer stories. He was buddies with Jimmy Page. He introduced him to Robert Plant before the formation of Led Zeppelin. He was asked to join Deep Purple when Rod Evans left. So before Ian Gillan was in the picture, it could have been Terry Reid. So he knows all these incredible folks. I mean, talking about his bio where he opened for Jethro Tull and he opened for the Rolling Stones, he opened for Cream. And that going back to the 60s when he was just a teenager. Well, he found these guys, the Cosmic American Derelicts, and I think they came to support him on tour. But then over the years, they've become friends. They become buddies. They share a love of this kind of country and rock music. They apparently also share a love of Westerns, which we're going to hear a little bit on the show. But they've got a great new album, Bergenfield Blues. It's already out in America. Comes out July 21st in the UK. And so we thought we would take some time to talk to Terry and to George of the Cosmic American Derelicts, who's kind of their main man. He's the lead songwriter and kind of the arranger of all their tunes, the leader of the band. And we caught him hanging on the couch one day while Terry's sitting there stringing up a 12-string. George is sitting there telling some great stories. It was a fun conversation. It's good to get to know some musicians who maybe aren't super well-known around the world, but are doing good work together. And Terry's on about five tunes on this record, some of them pretty darn bluesy. It's not really a country album per se. It's really got a little bit of everything in there for everybody. So we're going to get into our conversation with them very shortly. But first, we have a little bit of business to take care of. We are proud members of the Pantheon Podcast Network, a network of about 100 different music shows. Not all of them rock and roll. There's really something in there for everyone. And I encourage you to go to pantheonpodcast.com to learn more about all the other great shows. Or go to the App Store, pick up the Pantheon Podcast app, and then you can get every episode of all the different shows in one spot. We also have to encourage you to go to rarevinyl.com, our sponsor, who has an amazing collection of rock and roll and just music in general, records, memorabilia, whatever you want, more than 250,000 items in stock, based in the UK. And if you use the code UGLY, which is a new one, UGLY, you ain't got no alibi. You need to go to rarevinyl.com. I know we have a lot of record collectors. I know we have a lot of memorabilia collectors. You go to Rare Vinyl, you can find something. It's not just from the UK or US. They collect things from all over the world, and they ship all over the world. They take great care to collect this stuff, to curate it, and to get it to you in one piece. That's why they have a five-star rating on Trust Radius. And if you use our code UGLY, you can save yourself 10%. That might just help knock off the shipping, right? So whether you're in Southampton or South Africa, go to rarevinyl.com. Use the code UGLY. Save yourself 10%. Now back to Terry Reid, the Cosmic American Derelicts, and Bergen Field Blues. I was glad when I came to know this band. I was glad when I got a copy of their record to listen to, because it's got that blues that we really like here on the Ugly American Werewolf. Country isn't always our thing, like some folk music. But what is country but blues for white rural people, right? It's the same storytelling. It's the same bad stuff happens, but you got to get through it kind of thing. And so it melded well with kind of Terry's voice, George's songwriting and playing. They have a great band we're going to talk a little bit about here on the show. So why don't we go ahead and jump in here. Here we are talking with the legendary Terry Reid and George from the Cosmic American Derelicts on their new album, Bergen Field Blues, right here on The Wolf.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Well, first of all, George and Terry, welcome to the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast. We appreciate you coming on. Look, most of our listeners are like me and Jackson. They're about 50 years old, right? So maybe a little younger than some of us, maybe a little older than some of us, but grew up on 70s classic rock. So first question we want to know is, how does a rock legend like Terry Reid get hooked up with a bluegrass country blues outfit from Bergen Field, New Jersey, man?
Yeah, and I asked myself that.
That's a valid question.
Well, the thing was, is George asked himself the question because we met and I was coming to New York to do something. And George got hold of me and said, I tell you what, you come in, do you have a band? I said, what do you mean? They're doing California. He said, no, in New York. Are you going to bring the whole band? I said, well, things are a bit tough flying everybody here. I don't know. He said, well, we got a band, right? And we know a few of your songs. We'll learn the rest. Let's get together. We're more than willing to, you know, throw in there.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, well, okay. Well, what kind of band did these, you know? So we talked about it. We didn't send videos.
Enough. No, we just talked.
Yeah, we were very, very analog about it, you know. So he said, yeah, well, we play all kinds of music. We play like rock and roll and we play country music. I went, oh, well, that's right up my streets where I'm at. So he said, yeah. And we play some bluegrass. I went, oh, really? Oh, very interesting. So, but first he said rock and roll. So when I flew in here, right, we talked about a lot of my tunes, which are mixture. And then, but when I flew in here, I walk in the room here, in the back room, and there's like mandolin on the wall, you know, slide guitars. And I'm going, oh, wait a minute, what kind of rock and roll band are you in? Well, we're a bluegrass band that plays all this and it. So as we got to know each other, we find out that we love all the same things, whether it be the Louvin Brothers. I mean, you know, really off the chart things.
Yeah,
you know?
Marty Robbins, the Birds.
Marty Robbins, yeah. Oh, we just opened it. For Christmas, George bought me the whole Marty Robbins. It got so, you know, we play it all day long.
Yeah.
he said, well, Steve, I know you're going to steal my collection. I better get you one for Christmas, the big box set, you know.
Nice.
So that's how it started, and we've been how many years?
That was in 2007 when we we played BB King's the night after Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
With Dave Brubeck band was
Dave Brubeck in the afternoon.
In the afternoon.
Yeah. Right.
Cool. Yeah. And that's where it all started.
And you know what? Like when we were talking on the phone, I remember mentioning that my guitar player plays B Bender, like got Clarence White style.
Yeah.
And Terry was like, oh, you know, I love the Birds. And then like that was like one of the things too. He was like, oh, you guys like the Birds? And we're like, yeah, we love the Birds. You know?
We love the Birds.
That was one of the things that kind of brought us like our mutual admiration of like that whole California country thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's Buck Rainey who plays the B Bender.
Yeah, that's Eddie Rainey. Eddie Buck Rainey.
Yeah. Eddie Buck.
Yeah,
it's like Buck. Buck.
Yeah.
Nice.
Was he a five-pointer or something?
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit then, or for our listeners who are less familiar with your band, George. I mean, tell us how you got started in New Jersey and how you've grown out around the world.
Well, I don't know. We got together in, like, I think 1998, like the spring of 98. And it was like a band, but we all in other bands. And it was kind of like a band just put together to go, like, in town just at this bar to just hang out and do jam sessions on Sundays. And we just invite our friends up and, you know, everybody would swap songs. And it was, like, fun. And then both the bands that we were in broke up. And then, like, we kind of, like, merged the two bands together. And then that's how, like, the band started, you know. Like, and I was back in 98.
Right.
Gotcha. And then how did you find your way over to UK the first time?
Well, that was through Terry and this guy named Paul Bennett, who he saw us play with Terry at BB King's at the first show that we did with Terry. And he was a mate with Terry and kind of like, I guess, financing some shit in the background.
Yeah, he helped us out with the travel and everything over there.
Yeah.
He got a lovely big house there down in South End. Which is, you probably know better as much as me. South End is real close to London. It's only an hour.
Yeah.
Well, an hour if you don't get the traffic. 4 hours if you do, right?
Right, right.
But, so it was very convenient how we did it. And he had to travel. So we figured, oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And so we went over there and roamed around for a bit.
Yeah, it was great.
Got in trouble.
That can happen in those English pubs, I know firsthand.
Oh,
Jackson,
yeah. Happened at the gigs.
Yeah, happened at the gigs. It happened in the street. It happened in the pub.
Where we were
at the hotel.
It's really funny ones, right?
Yeah, that was 2008.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great partnership now. Decade and a half, man, still going strong. And now they're working together.
Yeah, like we're like best friends, you know, we're great friends, you know.
Yeah.
It goes beyond music at this point. It's just we're family, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're big Western fans.
Yeah.
Too. It's like all English guys. It's ironic, really. It's hard for me to find people in America or people of mine that really are Western fanatics.
Okay.
Right? Not just John Wayne, I mean, and not just Clint Eastwood, but, you know, go through the territory. It's just how the movies are made. What rock is in the background that was in another movie? Because, you know, when John Ford would do those movies, he would plan the background first. Then he put everybody in there, you know. I mean,
that's why it's so scenery and
everything. So me and George have fun spotting the scenery and spotting who's going to come up next.
Yeah, we're big Western fans. You know?
Yeah, because
we sit and watch Westerns all the time. You know, my girlfriend's like, enough with the Westerns already, you know? all day.
She just said before I turned up, I suppose you'll be busy this week. Your Western friend is coming in.
Yeah. And my wife, actually, both of our wives are the same way. It's like, oh, God, they're talking about rock and roll again. Will you just turn that off?
Yeah, we get round to the rock.
Oh,
rock.
Yeah.
That's why we do the show together, right? Because we got to have each other to bounce all this information and passion off of, right?
Yeah.
So. I was going to say, go down to the basement and talk to your friends.
That's what we hear most of the time. All right. So, you know, getting into the record a little bit here, Bergenfield Blues, which I guess is coming out. Well, a little later this month in the U.S., is it a July release date in the U.K.?
July. It's still selling it at our shows right now. We're doing now, but it's coming out like in general in July.
And you're playing New York right now. I mean, you're going to the Cutting Room.
Yeah, we're playing with Terry. We got a couple of gigs coming up this weekend. We're doing the Cutting Room this Friday in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the Turning Point in Piermont, New York.
Yeah, the Turning Point.
And then we're doing the Colony in Woodstock. Right. And then Terry's heading back home and he's going to go to Italy in June to do some.
Yeah, well, I'm coming back to do Ronnie Scott's in London in June.
I saw that. That's exciting.
Yeah,
man.
Around the 20th. That'd be great. With a whole a bunch of new lads that I haven't worked with. Well, the bass player, Jennifer Maidman, she's been with us for a long while.
Okay.
But the drummer and the guitar player, haven't met yet. We do one of those fly-by-night numbers, you know. So it'll be great. I've talked to him on the phone, and we're starting to get the whole set really, really honed in. But it's a bit of an adventure. I like that, you know.
Well, let's talk about New York for just one second, because I want to hear the difference between a guy who grew up in Jersey eventually going to play New York City, what that means for you, George. But now, Terry, you've been playing New York City, what, 55 years? I don't know, a long time.
You can tell by my accent I more or less live here. You
know? But, I mean, I remember.
I don't know what it is anymore. Really.
But every English artist who's around your generation will tell me about how, look, coming from England in the 60s, it was like black and white gray. And then I get to America in the late 60s, it's like Technicolor, you know? And I want to kind of hear a little bit about your perspective first playing New York and what it means to you now.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, it does. It hits you like lightning. I mean, you're always, as a band in England, and whichever band you're talking about, whether it was the Beatles or whoever it is the big thing is, when are we going to America?
Right.
And the Beatles kept saying, when are we going to America? When? And then they say, uh-oh, it's all breaking loose. You're going to have to go to America. And they went, uh-oh. This is a bit of the Stones too. But everybody, you know, was wanting to go to America. So when it came around for me, it was about 1968. That's what it was. And Eric Clapton asked me to go on tour with him over here. Just so, do you want to do some gigs, just our band and yours?
Yeah.
And I went, where are we going? And he said, well, we're going to the States. And I went, are you serious? Right. I said, well, wow, okay. He said, yeah, there's a string of gigs. So, you know, it'll be great. You go just the two bands and we'll do it. And I think just in New York, it was Buddy Miles was on it as well, who I knew from being out. So I said, so where are the gigs? He said, well, we're playing the Garden. And I said, whose Garden? What Garden? Hey, what he's talking about, right? And he said, I was like 17, 18 at the time, you know. He said, Madison Square Garden. You've got to be joking. What? You were playing Madison Square Gardens. So long story, when we turned up and realized, he wasn't bullying about it, you know, that's what he meant. We take one look at that and go, uh-oh. And then, but all the gigs were like either baseball stadiums or big gigs.
Is that right? Cream were set up baseball stadiums. Wow.
Yeah. There was one in Florida that was a big outdoor one that we did. That was, I remember that was sort of fun. And then Philadelphia Spectrum, which isn't there anymore.
Hockey. Those are arenas. Yeah, hockey arenas.
They're arenas. But that was the Spectrum being round. Like, I love that place.
Yeah, I saw a couple shows there back.
Did you? Yeah, that was a natural one for bands. But at this time in America, like this is retrospect, really, is you were just starting. They've got the festivals were starting, and that's just a big mess, you know. Right. But the big gigs. Then you start to see where that could be really good money makers for rock and roll bands. And I just found out recently the gig that we did with the Cream, that first gig, right, was the first rock and roll gig that they did at Madison Square Gardens.
Wow.
Yeah. A friend of mine, we're doing a biography thing, you know, doing a book thing. And she's picking up all this information. She said, did you know that it was the first one? And I said, well, you know, it did seem a bit funny because I did it again with the Stones later in 69. Okay. And they had the stage at one end. But when we did it with the Cream, we won that revolving stage. And it was like, it felt like, it didn't feel like Muhammad Ali, but, you know, I mean, that's a little pushing it. But, yeah, but that's the same stage, as you might say, the same spot that Sonny Liston and all
that's
all the big fights from way back, you know, and you couldn't get that out of your mind for some reason, you know, with the speakers above.
Well, you played there when it was the New Garden.
Yeah, that's the New Garden.
Because it was built, I think the New Garden was like 65 or 66 it was built.
Right.
Before that, it was someplace, it was down for.
Yeah, well.
So it was like relatively brand new, that particular version
of the Garden. That's true, but it's still been a bunch of fights.
Yeah, it was a bunch of fights in that place. Yeah, legendary.
Yeah, there's a bit of blood being spilt there, you know. I mean,
that's for sure.
All of that stuff we'd seen in England, so to come over to America and actually do that was, that to me was like really mind-blowing. That's just, you know, it's a special arena is Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, yeah. And then after that, is group after group and group, you know, made their careers out of it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
It's special.
So how old were you when you came over in 68?
Oh, about 12.
Yeah, I mean.
What was I, 17?
Oh my goodness! I mean, I saw an interview you did where you said you started as a pro touring with the Rolling Stones at 15.
Yeah, well, yeah, the pro thing always got me confused what that meant.
Well, getting paid. The rest,
the rest of the spelling of that, you know, you could make it up yourself. I did, but that was in 1965. I was 15.
Oh
right?
My goodness.
And we went out to, well, I left school and I've been watching all this going on TV with the Stones riots and all this, sitting there going, laughing like everybody did. Oh, look at that. Oh, wow. And it's pandemonium. Next thing, I left school. Mick and Keith asked me to go on the tour. And within 2 days, we're at the Albert Hall in a riot. So the thing was, all my mates from school, I told them I'm going on tour with the Rolling Stones. Saying, yeah, very funny. That's it's your round, right? they wouldn't believe me, right? And then 2 days later, they see me running for my life across the stage. It's like, whether they believed it or not, or believed that I'm on the ticket, you know, on the poster, they see me running, right? Then it hit all of us, you know, the tour. And it was like that, the whole tour. It was a Screamers tour, you know. It was,
right.
You never heard a damn thing.
They're playing 10 minutes of getting chased off the stage.
It was like, now we have, that was it. Never heard anything. I thought they were going to listen to what we were doing. But that was it.
So is it safe to guess, George, that your first gig wasn't at Madison Square Garden in the city?
It's very safe to say that.
Yeah, what was your first experience getting to play in New York?
I don't know. I guess when I was like 17 or 18, I started going down to the city to this place called the Downtime, and it used to be like all like the musicians used to hang out there.
Where was that?
It was right around the corner from the Garden.
Ah, right.
Like, I guess Garden's on 32nd Street. I think it's on 30th Street.
Where the Belt Forum sort of is on that side. No?
Yeah, but that's still the Garden. This is like two blocks, like a block down.
All right. Okay.
And there's like a studio up, like a big famous studio. I can't remember the name of it. It was up above the bar. So all the musicians, when they were done doing sessions, would come downstairs and hang out in this particular bar.
One we went to. No. We didn't get in that.
No.
Okay, good.
So we started, they used to do jam sessions on like Sunday nights, I want to say. It's hard to remember. It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And me and my brother, I used to play with my brother. He was the drummer and a friend and just one of the original derelicts, Mike Corr. We were like a trio. So we'd go down there and we'd, you know, do our Hendrix and Paul Butterfield and stuff like that. And, you know, we met, you know, Michael Powers, who's a great New York guitar player. We backed him. His band didn't show up for a gig and we were there doing a jam. And he's like, hey, man, I need you guys to back me up. And we just backed him up for like the whole night. And we kind of met a couple of cats from New York and I just started playing, you know, slowly but surely, you know, playing music down there, you know. And then actually auditioned for a band called the Bleeding Hearts, which Joe Wilkinson, the guitar player that's on Burgundy Field Blues, was his band. I answered an ad in The Voice and I went down to the city and auditioned for him. And we clicked right away.
Ooh.
And, you know, within a month we were playing like all the clubs in the city, like New Music Cafe and CBGB's and we did that. And Arlene's Grocery and the Elbow Room. And, you know, we just were playing the whole New York circuit, you know?
Yeah, there were so many good clubs.
Yeah, there were so many good clubs back then.
And the Village was jumping too.
And even then, like what I'm talking about, it was like the end of it. Right. You know, like you were like where it was like really happening.
Yeah, well.
You know, like music, like by the time I was there, the rock and roll was kind of dead in New York. It was like, at the end of it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it was in the '90s, like the late '90s. By 2000s, rock and roll kind of died. Yeah, once they put the smoking ban in, all the clubs closed. It was like so
right.
All
right.
The old school clubs closed.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, how can you stay alive? You know, it's like you can't have a garden in the middle of 8th Avenue, you know? That French thing doesn't work.
They changed everything, you know. Well, whatever, it's just time, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a bummer for me, you know, because I grew up in the Midwest. And by the time I was old enough to, like, start doing business in the city and come and visit maybe a couple times a year, I'd be like, okay, I'll do business during the day. And then at night, I want to go to CBGB's. I want to go to, you know, wherever. And they're like, oh, no, you can't go there anymore. They shut that down. Or, like, they don't get bands there anymore. I'm like, what the fuck? It's New York City, man.
Really?
You know? Yeah,
I think CBGB's is now a John Varvatos store.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Oh, awesome.
I mean, Bleecker Street, it's like three bars are left, you know, like the old school, you know, the Bitter End's still there.
Yeah.
The Peculiar Pub, I think, is still there. And, like, the Red Line. And other than that, everything's closed. Like, you know, so many places. I used to live on Bleecker Street, that whole area. I was like, down there for
Bleecker and McDougal.
Sullivan Street, all those streets, clubs everywhere, man. It's just not, you know, it isn't the same. I mean, rock and roll's not that doesn't dominate anymore. It's just not that hip anymore. You
look at the village. I don't know what happened to it.
It's a lot of money, you know.
Well, I know it's money.
Poor broke artists can't afford to live in the village. You know?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah, that's right.
Hey, this is Scott Holiday from the Rival Sons. You're listening to The Ugly American Werewolf in London.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Oh, well, let's talk about your record a little bit here, man, because we got to listen to it here this last week or so. And we're starting to really dig this thing. I'm almost, guys, I got to listen to it three or four times before it really starts to sink in. And thank goodness it is, you know. And God, you're showing off all your different styles here, George. I mean, I know, Terry, you're on about, what, five or six tracks, something like that?
Yeah. But while I was here and everything, George said, you want to go in the studio and do some things with the band, you know?
Yeah.
Seeing that we're a band here when we're here and everything, I said, hell yeah, you know, why not?
Well, you know what it was? When I first met Terry, he'd only come out like maybe once a year to do like one of the shows. And then over the years, like the last, like before COVID, like the last 3 or 4 years, he was coming out 2-3 times a year. And I'd just been writing a lot and just recording stuff. And then like every time he was here, I was like, you know what? Let's track a tune. Why not? You know, like you're here. Because he was here so much and it just kind of like snowballed. It wasn't like, I never like planned to record a ton of songs or anything. It just kind of, over the years, just we accumulated a bunch of songs.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. You know, but George got into writing a bunch of them. So, and I got to be the singer.
Yeah.
You know, so, like anything in the band. Well, what do you do? Well, little as possible.
Well, do you write on the bass, George? That's where you...
I did. Sometimes I write on the bass. Sometimes I write on the acoustic, you know, for the most part, you know. It depends on, like, the song. Sometimes, like, if it's a groove, 90% of the time, it'll be off the bass.
Sure.
If it's, like, a strummy thing, it's, like, my cheesy guitar playing.
Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah. And that's where the inspiration comes from. And then
I'm a bass player. I don't really play guitar, but I can write on it, you know?
Yeah, I think that couch has a lot to do with it.
Yes, the couch definitely has a lot to do with it, man. Yeah.
Put strings on that.
Because I see you as the driving creative force in the band. There are other songwriters in your band.
Yeah, there are other songwriters in the band. And like the other guys write a lot. It was just like the other guys write more like country and bluegrassy country stuff. Not that I don't write that stuff too, but just over the years lately, I've just been writing a lot of blues stuff. And I've always wanted to record a blues record. Not that this is a full blown blues record because it has other shit on it.
That's right.
But you know, it's based in the blues, you know? So like I always wanted to put on I Love the Blues, you know, like we are usually more like Southern honky tonk kind of music, you know. So this was like just a little departure from that, and I could feature some different musicians that have been in and out of the band over the years, you know. So it was just something different to, you know, to go and do. You know, we're still writing the country stuff and bluegrass stuff all the time as well, you know.
Yeah, sure. But no, there's a lot of great blues, and you mix the blues in the country really well on here. And
then because the country's still blue, you know what I mean? Like as long as it has that ethos and that blueness, that's what makes it blue, you know. Like it's
blue.
There you go. That's
very nice. That's the kind of blues it is. Gold is blue glitter.
Sweet, man. Yeah. All right. Well, so what about like, I don't know, something like the Black Sunrise song, you know? I put this on and I'm like, I'm taking this. This has got smooth little vocals on here, but then it's starting to mix up. It's telling a story, which is very country and blues, you know, kind of at the same time. You've got a lot of different instruments on there. I don't know. It all blends together really well for me, man. What was the inspiration behind that one?
Well, I'll be honest. It was mostly like Jimi Hendrix, like just the groove I was kind of going for, like a kind of like that says like looping bluesy groove that he used to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, just the blues and, you know, it's the theme, like the themes of blues, you know, like your women leaving you a train, you know. It just won't, you know, it just, I don't know, like, I don't, it just comes out, you know, like, I don't really think about it too much, you know. If the words come and they sound cool, you know. Gotcha. There's a lot of them that come out that don't sound cool, you know, just put them away, you know.
We haven't got around to doing a Louvin', writing a Louvin'.
No, so. We got it, man. That's which next means, on the list.
So what you do is you have a girlfriend, you go to the bar, get drunk, murder your, go on, have a fight with your girlfriend, murder her, right, throw her in the river. Right.
And then we got a song.
Yeah, and then we got a song. I mean, when I started listening to the Louvin Brothers, I loved the harmonies because those families, the bluegrass thing, are like the Everly Brothers, they were all that same kind of...
they're related to the Louvin Brothers.
They were? Yeah.
They're related. They're like second cousins or third cousins.
Yeah, they're third cousins. Yeah. I mean, but I never listened to the lyrics. When I listened to the lyrics, I went, wait a minute. These guys are nuts. What do you mean you threw her in the river and expect and then went and turned yourself in?
Right? Yeah, what was the point?
It's fascinating, the subject matter of them.
You're going to go to that trouble.
I've smashed more things up listening to sad country music than I ever did listening to hard rock or heavy metal. I mean, seriously, I've gotten more depressed listening to that kind of depressing stuff than like that shit just touches you, you know? Yeah. Like, it's pure, you know?
It's very real. It's very real.
Yeah. That's what we always say. It's like you couldn't do a I'm standing next to a mountain chopping down with my edge of my head in a country song because, like, what's that about? You have to sing about something real. You know, you have to sing about your woman doing you wrong. Your truck is rusted out. You know, whatever it is, it has to be real life.
Yes. It's not, fantastic. They don't deal with abstractions. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's amazing. Well, they were two crazy guys anyway.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
But they had a sad end too, you know.
Honestly, like you told me this was a country record. And so I was like, okay, I went into it. There are country elements, but I'm telling you what, that slide guitar on this record is phenomenal. I mean, it's got Allman Brothers all over it.
He's a real talent. He really is.
What's the name of your keyboard player?
Rob Clores.
Clores.
Yeah. Yeah, he used to play with the Crows a couple of years ago. When the original keyboard player, I cannot think of his name, got sick and went into rehab, Rob toured with him for like 2 years.
He's all over this thing, and he's phenomenal, man.
Yeah, he's all over the record, man. He's been on our records for like the last, since like 2007. Right. I've had him on and off on records, you know, when I need him and stuff. He's a great guy. He's like, grew up like a couple of towns away from me. I met him about 15, 16 years ago, and we've been friends ever since, you know, and he's a, you know, real pro. He knows his shit, you know?
He seems to, man, because a lot of times the keyboard is, I don't know, it's almost like they're fighting for the same space as the guitar player.
Yeah.
Not on this, man. It all fits together really well.
Thank you. He's real deal, man. And it's a pleasure to work with. He doesn't have a big head. He comes in, does his thing, you know, he has a drink, we laugh, you know. It's all fantastic family. You know, I like working with people that I feel kindred to, not you know, strangers all the time. I mean, I don't mind playing with strangers if, like, you connect with them. But, yeah, you know, we got our little musical family, and it's a lot of fun.
And it's nice to hear the vocal change-ups, too, on this. You've got some songs that Terry sings, some songs, you know, other people sing on the record, back and forth.
Yeah.
Nice change-up. And the styles change, too. You got a little bit of blues, a little bit of country, a little bit of kind of a hybrid of both of those things.
Yeah, there's a little R&B on there,
yeah,
too. You know?
Yeah.
With the chick singing in the background and stuff. Mm-hmm. I got a little of that going as well, you know?
Yeah, it's like a bang.
Yeah. It's to make every song sound, you know, individual and, mm-hmm, you know.
But it sounds like a big band. I mean, this is like three or four guys. It sounds more like, you know, you've got 7-8 people, which isn't always the case.
Yeah, well, it's not. Usually when we play, we're like a 5-piece, you know? And sometimes I have a fiddle player sit in whenever he can make it. So it's a 6-piece. And sometimes, when we play, we don't have keyboards because he's always on tour and stuff. He tours with a lot of cats. So
gotcha.
It's hard to get him, you know, to tour, to play with us, you know. But when it's studio, he's always here for us, you know.
That's cool. Yeah, no, that's awesome. Now, I haven't listened to every single one of your albums, like, to review it. So I'm not, I've listened to them all, but I haven't listened to them, like, intently to go in with a pen and make a bunch of notes. But you have some great instrumentals on here, you know, like a Blues 22 or the Greek Mac, which I assume is you, George.
Yeah.
You know, because you're the Greek Mac. But, you know, is that something you like to do? Like, let's just do a jam and instrumental, and that's something you can stretch out live?
I love Ramsey Lewis, and I love, like, Booker T and the MGs. I love Jimmy Smith. And I love the Allman Brothers. Like, you know, I love Pink Floyd. Those guys are all – they do instrumental, big instrumental suites, and some of them are short, some of them are long. I just like instrumentals. I got great guitar players in the band.
Yeah.
I got a great organ player. Let's show them off, you know. Let them groove a little bit, you know. And I don't know. I just enjoy, like, the instrumental stuff a lot, to be honest with you. It's fun, you know.
The
dance is good, too, right. Yeah.
And you can stretch them out live if you want to, man. Just
yes,
let
exactly,
people jam,
exactly, you know?
Yeah. Now, Terry, I mean, you didn't write these with George. George came to you like, here's what I got. You're like, oh, yeah, I can sing those. Or did you add a little something?
It's like with any singer, what you should do, you take it on, you listen to it, and you listen to what it's about, you listen to it, and then you just start crafting it into how you would do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As it is, George he's not Mario Lanza. No, mate, I'm being nice about it.
No, it's all good.
He'll hum me the melody a bit and give me the lyric. But the main thing is give me the lyric, right? So it's not like I've got somebody who's singing it to me that already has a set style that there you go. And if you try and get away from it, you lose the song. That can happen with a lot of songs, you know. You start singing it your way, suddenly it's another song,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I had free rein, as you might say, a free rein to do what I wanted to do with the material, right? Which is great. That's different. You don't usually, when I work for a lot of different people doing songs and off the cuff and different things, but they're usually set in stone or, you know, they have an arrangement in the background, which you're locked into. It's like an engine, you know, mm-hmm. You've got to stay with all the parameters, right?
Right.
But it's great. We just buddies.
Yeah. We just like to hang out and make music together, you know?
Watch Westerns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The music's incidental. It's all about the Westerns and the brisket sandwiches.
Yeah. Nice.
You can tell that on the record that it really seems like you guys are all just, I mean, you're making music. Yes, it's a professional deal, but it sounds like you're all having a good time. It's very cohesive, just one big jam session.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much, you know, like it was funny. Like, I mean, the tunes I recorded that I had Terry sing on, I recorded at this studio in Teaneck, New Jersey, which is actually Terry's adopted hometown.
Yes, I tell him. I'm from Teaneck, and I can nearly get beat up in the bar. I did it in California. There's a guy I knew from New York, and he's hey, and he's talking next to me in the bar to somebody. And I'm from so-and-so, and they say, I'm from Teaneck. And I went, oh, my hometown. And he looked at me, if looks could kill. He's like, he's not having that at all, right? You know? I said, I'm joking.
So the five songs that we did with Terry, I recorded at this studio, and it's actually the board that used to be in Tony Bennett's studio, which is in Englewood, New Jersey, which is the town over.
Wow.
And they took the board, and the guy bought it. His guy's name is Andreas. And now he's a professional drummer. I can't think of his last name, but he's a great bloke. And he got the board in his house, and he's got the engineer that used to work at Bennett Studios, and they do the sessions out of there. So we went there, and they have the Hammond organ there, and they have, you know, the guy has like 15 different vintage drum sets. And so he had all the gear there, and we tracked those tunes there. And all the other stuff I recorded here in my house, in my studio.
Wow.
And, you know, it was kind of like a lot of the stuff I really, you know, like we didn't over rehearse anything. Like a couple of the songs, we pretty much, I wrote them like on a Friday, and by next Friday, we were tracking them. You know, maybe like one or two rehearsals just to run through them. Like I was trying to just, you know, writing because they were coming out fast, and I wanted to keep that fast and loose.
Yeah.
Video. And I don't want, I don't know, sometimes you over rehearse stuff and it, after a while, you don't want to record it because you played it 1,000 times.
Yeah,
you
know.
So it was cool that it was like, and at the time, a lot of the stuff was during the pandemic. So my engineer was out of work. Everybody was out of work. So I was just like, dude, look, come over for 3 days and let's just track. And we, you know, grab a couple of drinks, have a smoke, have a slice of pizza, and just take our time all day long playing. And all right, this one sounds cool. This one doesn't. Let's keep that. And then that's how it kind of started. You know, I was going for like a very loose feel to it. I wasn't trying to make a Yes album or, you know, like an Eagles album where you don't hear the hiccups. I don't care if it's a little, if there's a hiccup here or a little loose thing there. It's rock and roll. In the end, it's all rock and roll, you know.
If it's a Yes album, you've been there for 2 years.
Oh. Well, it definitely sounds like an album that's made to be played live.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've been starting to play some of the songs live because in a pandemic we weren't getting, it was real crazy because like some of the guys live far away in the band, so just getting everybody in the room together, it was like, you know, it was me and Eddie and my other drummer. Eddie played drums, he also is the guitar player that plays the slide, so me and him did a lot of the stuff, bass and drums, with my other drummer adding other, you know, doing some other stuff with us as well. So it was like we were building the bass drums, and then Eddie would add acoustic. Then my singer would come up, and I'd teach him the song. He'd do the song and go home, and then he would never even play on it. You know, it was just the way we all put it together because I was just, you know, slow. And then some of the stuff everybody plays on, but it was just, can you make it? You can't make it, or I'll get the other cat to come and make it. You know, it's just like kind of like that. You know, whoever could come in and add some of their talent to it, you know, kind of happened like that, you know. And a lot of it was recorded. Most of it was recorded live, bass drums and guitar. It was as a trio, and then we overdubbed everything else and added everything.
Cool. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. All the rhythm tracks are live, and most of them are like within like the second or third take. We didn't do like 10 takes of stuff. We just went fast and loose with it, you know?
And that's where the feel on this record comes from, because you recorded the rhythm together live.
Live. You know, like the keyboard player's there when we're doing it, you know, as a trio, you know, with the bass drums and everything. It's all there.
That's awesome. Well, and to sidestep for one moment, you mentioned Yes record. I know we were kind of joking about that. But in getting prepared for this, I didn't realize that you had played with Alan White back in the day, Terry. I mean, it should shock me.
Because
you played with so many.
Yeah, that was a whole fiasco. I decided to put the ultimate band together. The best band in. Well, we all do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it ends up sounding like a mess. But you try, at least you start off with that idea, right? So what I did, we were running around in England and we'd been in the States, and I slowly got into, which is my main influence, is R&B. And I'd live and die for all those four Tops records, Levi, and all that. That was just all I liked, and jazz things. So I thought, I know what, let's try and put a country, a little bit country, rock and roll, R&B. So a friend of mine, Lee Miles, who was with Ike Turner, he joined me in England. And we started putting the band together. And the only drummer that really hung heavy and could pull it off was Alan White, right?
Yeah.
But Alan was busy. He's working with all different groups. And also he's working with John Lennon doing the magic. So the schedule's got really. John Lennon called me up one day. I don't get me wrong. It sounds a little brash. But I didn't know John. I wish I did. But we double booked the gig. You know how that can be, right? That's dead. But the gig, we pulled out twice before from problems with the agent who double booked it or something. Right? So this will be the third time out, which is you get blackballed for that, right?
Right.
So I get this phone call from John Lennon, and he says, "Hello, Terry, it's John." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Oh," he says, "you got a real problem." He said, "Our band had the same problem. You got to do that third gig, or you'll never play that circuit again." He said it nearly ruined our band. And I'm just going, yeah, yeah, your band, yeah, what band was? Oh, yeah, right, the Beatles.
That little quartet, yeah. What
he's talking about, right? So he sent Alan up in a car, right, like with the driver, nice. So we could go up and do the. It was Leicester, not Dumfries, Leicester Polytechnic, no, Loughborough University. That's what it was. Yeah. Right. I can never forget. I don't know how I remember these things, but it was. I think I was in shock that we weren't going to do the gig, so I remembered it, you know.
Nice.
We had him, and then we got David Lindley in the band as well.
God rest his
soul. Who just passed away this year, which is really sad. I can't believe it, you know, but shit happens, as they say, you know.
That's right.
We're all living on. We've been living on the edge for years, anyway. I don't know how we got this far, really.
But you're not the only one of your generation who's still out there doing it. I mean, you mentioned some of the guys you played with, the Rolling Stones. They're still doing it. Clapton's still doing it. You toured with the original Fleetwood Mac. Mick and John are still doing it.
Yeah. Right?
You know, Jethro Tull is still doing it.
I get to see all them guys too, and they're all like still, you know, they're all still raving around. My friend Graham Nash, you know, he's just finishing up a tour. And him and Paul McCartney are 80, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just done a real successful tour and that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we got here. That's amazing, you know. After all the, you know, what happened and what everybody did. Gosh, truth or mate, it's a wonder, you know.
I know. Well, what about you, George? Are you going to be doing this in your 80s, you feel like?
I'm going to do it till the day I die.
That's what I want to hear.
I think most musicians are like, it's not something you can retire from. If it's in you, it's in you, you know. You can walk away from it, but it always calls you, you know. I don't know. It's just, it's in you. I'm going to play, whether I play, professionally, I'm going to pick up my guitar as much as I can till the day I die, you know. That's what it's all about. Yeah. I said that when I was 16, and I still hold by those principles from back then, you know?
Well, you're a terrible plumber. You're going to
have to. Yeah. No, God bless you.
You're not doing my plumbing, right?
No, all musicians should be that way. I mean, you're not an accountant, you know?
Yeah.
You do something you love. You do something that changes people's lives for the better, you know? And like you say, if you're just going to sit in your basement and strum, you're still doing it.
You're doing it, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, listen. I'm sorry.
No, go on.
Listen, man, the Rolling Stones, as much as they do it for money, they don't need the money. They do it because, you know what? It feels awesome to have 60,000 people knowing every word of your songs and clapping and cheering. And that's an energy that you feel. And they felt that all their lives. And now to stop feeling that energy, it's like stopping. It's like a drug almost, you know, that feeling, your euphoria you feel when so many people are giving you that energy, you know, like. It's great. The millions of dollars are great, but that feeling's just as great, you know, at that level of when you're an artist and you have that many people that you know, like you touch so many lives with your music. That's a big deal, man.
Let's still keep going, coming to the gigs, you know.
Keith can't spend that money anymore. He's doing it to get off. He's doing it to be in front of people. Yeah.
Oh, Keith. He never leaves the studio, Keith.
Yeah.
He's got time booked in every city in the world just in case he gets an idea. Right. You might have an idea. Where am I?
Yeah.
Okay. You did book that studio last month, right? Yeah, right. It's mad.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Gary Rossiter. The guy had a heart attack on stage. Apologized to the fans. Then for the next like 3, 4, 5 years, whatever it was, he kept touring with them, having mini heart attacks. He'd miss a gig. Those guys could sell Freebird to Ford and make a bajillion dollars selling cars with that song. The guy's, that guy has plenty of money. He don't need to do it. You know why he did it? Because he loved being on that stage playing those tunes, man. And that's the bottom line. You know, if you're real musicians, you know, that's all the bluegrass guys. They all play till they're in there. Ralph Stanley played till he was 90 years old, you know? Yeah. Like, even the jazz guys. You know, I saw Max Roach. He was 85 years old. Still out there playing the four-piece, swinging like a son of a bitch, you know?
The one that always got me, that I got to know real well, who fascinated me, who was, I think he was 80 when I met him, or 70, was Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Oh, Jack was... I don't know. I think he was 100 and he's still going around in that Volkswagen bus with his daughter. He got his daughter running things, right? But he was a fascinating case because he was an anthology of everything from Woody Guthrie through to rock and roll.
Yeah.
Right? So when he started telling stories, you got the big picture. you know, oh yeah, my friend Keith Richards and this and that. Yeah, and Woody would have loved this, and you know, they all just
yeah, he knew everybody.
He really knew what he got through.
Hey, this is Scott Holiday from the Rival Sons. You're listening to the Ugly American Werewolf in London.
I gotta say thanks for a couple of songs on this album. For one, Stop Talking. But Time Only Tells, man. And I think you're on that.
Yeah, Terry sings in that one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I got Cindy Cashdollar also playing that electric dobro on there. She's killer, man.
Oh, she's killer on
it. Yeah, she's something else.
To me, that's a classic blend of country and the blues. It's a lament, but it's not all sad. It's just a killer classic tune, man. And I dig it. And you wrap the album up with it. You know, it's not just like, okay, well, here's our last song. You probably didn't even listen this far. So we'll just put,
I put it there specifically to end the album, like Time Only Tells. You know, who knows if there'll be a next one? Who knows where we'll be? You know, kind of like, you know, I don't know. I put thought into it.
Good for you. Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, I'm a huge Skinner fan, and I love like Ronnie's ballads. And it was kind of like it was inspired by like listening to a lot of like the Ronnie stuff, you know. And I kind of – and then when I wrote it, I kind of was doing it more like a Skinner way. And then me and my Eddie, the guitar player, we would do – I wrote it like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we recorded it, but it wasn't jiving. It just wasn't right at that time, I guess. It hasn't coalesced yet. We were jamming bass and drums. And I started playing it, but I couldn't remember it. So I was playing it in like kind of like a different time or feel.
Okay.
And then Eddie started playing like this, like Otis Redding kind of like drum beat to it. And that's when it kind of fell together. And I was like, holy shit. All right. This is the way we got to do it. And then, you know, that's it. We went from there, and, you know, built the song up and everything.
It's amazing how that works. You think it's one thing. It's not working for whatever reason. Put it on the shelf or let it simmer, whatever. And then it's a little different. Or you put one new thing in the mix. And all of a sudden, oh, that's what it was supposed to be all
along. Well, you know, sometimes songs stay with you. Sometimes you write a song and you forget it because it's not, you know, whatever. But some stay with you for a while and you know it's something, but it's not quite there yet.
It just doesn't seem right.
Yeah, it doesn't at that moment. Or with
you love the song. You love the song. Hear it. But I don't think disco really fits it. You know? or whatever. You know, you get some. I went through a funny one like that with George Michael in England. And he was in the studio, lovely guy, great guy. I mean, he's the friendliest guy in the world, right? And I'm in, working with Trevor Horn in the studio downstairs at Sarpen. And he's got this whole studio upstairs that he's took over. And he's every day there's more equipment going in. I don't know how they fitted it all in there. It was like the shuttle going to the moon. I mean, in there, it's so hot, you had fans everywhere. Anyway, he was, he had that song, Father Figure. Right. And he had it for a long time, and he'd had it as all I want is Bobby talk about anything like wow,
dance, you know,
So he's doing that, and he just says, you know, Terry, it never sounded right. Let me play you what I just did to it. He played me the disco the dance thing first. Then he played me what he just done. He recut it as a ballad. It's just like a real spooky ballad. Went number one.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
Well, I said to him, did everybody not like the other version? He said, well, actually, everybody liked it. That's why I didn't like it. He said, I liked the song, but it just didn't seem right. Fantastic.
There you go,
Good decision.
And so, yes, you've worked with some legendary producers over the years. You mentioned Trevor Horn. Chris Kimsey worked with at the end of the 70s. Your buddy, Graham Nash, you know.
Yeah, right.
So many folks. Did anyone stick out? It's like, that was the guy who got me the best.
What? How do you mean?
As far as...
Who was the...
The producer that brought the best out of you, who got you as an artist the best.
I would say, well, it's a combination. It's never one thing. But working with Graham, I know... It's that same thing again. It's not just about the music. It's when you know somebody, you listen to them.
You respect them, right?
Some new guy that's all full of, you know, bells and whistles and that. It's like, I don't know about this. Sure. It might work, it might not. But Graham, I'd known for, since I was 14 or something, with the Hollies and that. Wow. So we'd been through a lot of stuff, you know. Well, he'd been through a lot of stuff. And, you know, I watched all this go down between us. And then when he said, let's do an album, I went, oh, well, there's an idea for you. And I sent him the songs and he loved them. So we went in with Al Schmidt doing the engineering, who was an integral part of the thing. Who, this is the man that cut Sam Cooke's records, right? Oh, I mean, come on. So Terry's, that's it. I'm in heaven now, yeah. You know. So Graham put a situation together that wasn't just it's some of the people that I played with all the time, like Soko Richardson from Mike and Tina and Lee Miles on bass, Mike and Tina, and that R&B section, and then and Ben Keith on the pedal steel, and Al Perkins playing like an orchestra. There's all these things going on, you know. So Graham was like, right, you know, throwing it this way and that way. It was brilliant. It's the most fun I've ever
had. Which is what a producer's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Is hear the stuff that you don't hear.
Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to listen to what the song is that the guy's playing and then color it accordingly. You know, let everybody agrees. Not, oh, this is my way of doing it. Yeah. You know, you're getting a big trouble doing that, you know.
But that's an interesting concept too. We focus a lot on the producer, but from what you're saying, it's really more of the cocktail of everybody that's there. You know, the engineer, the sound, all of that has to come together.
Yeah, it is, because you know, engineers. There's engineers that do all that work and put it together. Like Jeff Emmerich was the most well known. You wouldn't want his job, you know. I mean, these guys like make all these tapes and things, and they put this in and go, okay, we're going home now, Jeff. You put it together. Poor guy. I mean, he spent more times in the studio, more hours in the studio than any human being.
Yeah. Right?
But it's down to the engineer, whatever the project is, they've got to make that sonically right within keeping with what the description of the music is, you know, whether it's country. Yeah, you can make country record. I mean, these days, sometimes you get country rock and roll records. I don't know. Sometimes it irritates me, you know, because the mix is rock and they're doing it because to get the numbers and sell.
But it's not authentic.
Well, it doesn't relate to really anything. It's like, yeah, I know. Unless it's a really good looking girl up there doing it. And then you really give a damn anyway, right? Yeah. So, they make sure of that.
Well, this has been a blast, gentlemen. I'm really glad that you came on the show. It's really cool to meet you all. I'm really psyched for you to put this record out in the world and to get out there and play some, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us. This is a good conversation.
Appreciate it. Any you want to plug any social media or websites or gigs?
Yeah,
terryreed.com.
Mm-hmm. Right.
CosmicAmericanDerelicts.com.
Right.
And, you know, you can search the Cosmic American Derelicts and Terry Reed. We both have Facebook pages. That's about it, I think, for the social media. I don't know if Terry has other social media.
Yeah, just so Instagram. By the time this comes out, maybe we do Ronnie Scott's. I'm not sure whether we're there yet. But for anybody in England, if you happen to hear this before the gig, please come. And then later in the year, in October, we're doing the Jazz Cafe, right? Which we've been trying to do for the last 4 years. But, you know, between COVID and everything else, I mean, it's like, is it on? No, it's not. Is it on? No, it's on. Is it on? No, it isn't. Right. I mean, it got to the point where the guy at the club said, I don't want to do it anymore. Don't mention that word, Terry Rick. I don't want to hear about it. The poor guy running the club, he's had so many problems. It's amazing he's still.
Yeah, they almost closed.
They almost did lose it.
So many in the UK, man. I mean, I was there during COVID, and you know, you would see tumbleweeds going down Abbey Road, man. I'm like, what the?
Yeah.
When are they going to open this back up, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. They've gone through enough with going audio-visual with the place, you know, and changing it all around. Still has that sound. It's classic. Yeah. But, I mean, they changed all the gear and everything. And they really just got it on its feet for movies and cutting things. A lot of work went down the tubes, all those orchestra sessions, which they're famous for, you know, in that big room.
Yeah.
But thank God that some of them, God bless, are still around. So we'll, you know, it's like the clubs and all of them. And we got to just do what, put up with it, haven't we?
Yeah.
and soldier on. And I'm glad that we got turned on to you guys. We'll do whatever we can to turn some more folks on to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. That was
God bless.
Thank you.
Have fun on the road these days, and good luck with the record. Yeah.
Thank you very much for everything. God bless.
Thanks.
Cool. Well, interesting couple of characters there, Jackson.
I'll tell you what, that's another, they could probably have talked for another several hours just about, you know, stories from the road. And I mean, Terry, I admittedly didn't know that much about Terry Reed before we started into this. Mm. Holy crap. You talk about a guy who knew everybody. I mean, he's like, oh yeah, my friend Graham Nash, I've known him since 1966. Okay, sure.
Yeah. You know, when Robert Plant calls you the voice of a generation, that means you're the voice of a generation. That's not some odd critic who's trying to come up with somebody rare that you don't know about. That's the voice of a generation, paying homage to his voice of the generation, right? I mean,
just a really cool guy too. Just somebody who, like, the stories that he told earlier and the other interviews that I've seen, it's just very matter of fact. It's not like, well, I did this or I, it's just like, yeah, we were just hanging out and this is what happened. Yeah. Jimi Hendrix walks by and he plugs in and just goes to town. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I know. And like, you see who he toured with, like in the 60s and 70s. Like, if we talk about opening for the Stones, you know, opening for Cream at Square Garden as a teenager, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Opening for Jethro Tull and the original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green. I'm like, damn, dude, you know, and you wonder what it was about, I guess. You know, Mickey Most kind of screwed him over.
That's what it sounds like. That was a big hole that he put in his career. Because I guess he couldn't release any of his stuff for a while.
Right. No, he couldn't. He couldn't record, or he couldn't put it out. I guess he could record all he wants, but there's nowhere he could go with it. And, you know, obviously, most casual rock fans, you bring up Terry Fees, oh, yeah, he's the one who introduced Robert Plant to Jimmy Page. Yes, okay, that's an old story. True, I guess, but it wouldn't have been the same. Look, things happen for a reason, you know, and Led Zeppelin are who they are, and Terry Reed is who he is, and he's awesome. You know, mm-hmm. He's quite the character, and he still had a wonderful career. And look, he's got George, his best buddy now. Look, those guys, you could tell, they were tight as hell. He was sitting there stringing a 12-string guitar.
That was awesome.
The whole time we were talking.
I have to admit, I was a little disappointed. I kind of thought maybe he'd strum a little bit. But yeah, it was cool. Yeah, just matter of fact, just putting stuff together. I guess they were at the studio or something. That's what it looked like. Yeah, just two guys having a good time.
I mean, that might have been George's place because they're getting ready to do some shows around New York here in the next week or so. So
unbelievably bizarre for me to hear this music and then you hear him talk, George. Like, yep. That's New Jersey.
He's from New Jersey. Yeah, that's for sure. He's got the New Jersey accent, no doubt.
You would think, like, well, what kind of music? Oh, you know, like, you know, Springsteen-esque hard rock. No, it's. I would have sworn they were from down here in Jacksonville.
I was going to say, I bet it sounds like the band. Sounds like they're right up from the road from where you are, man.
Correct. Yeah, you know, kind of a little bit Skinnerd, a little bit Allman Brothers mixed together. No, we're from New Jersey. Really? All right.
And how cool is it that we got a firsthand John Lennon story?
Right?
First time we ever had one of those.
Yeah. That just, I mean, I could just sit there and listen to him talk for hours, just whatever you want. I mean, just story after story after story. And like I said, told in a very matter of fact way. Like, he, you know, the whole thing about Lennon said, you've got to play this show or you're out. All right. I guess we're doing this.
Right. Because you figure John Lennon's like, okay, look, we're double booked. I'm John Lennon and you're not. I'm taking the drummer to my gig.
Yeah.
And it was the opposite. He's like, no, man, you can't go out three times. You'll get blackballed. You got to go play that gig. It happened to us once, my little band, a little quartet you had from Liverpool. Whatever happened to them, by the way?
Yeah. They were going to be big. Oh, well.
And that's why we do this show, to keep rock alive, to keep new music like Bergenfield Blues up in people's faces, but also the stories of rock and roll, like John Lennon calling up Terry Reed to say, you've got to take Alan White to the gig because you're going to get blackballed if you don't, and I'll find somebody else. Because I guess I'm John Lennon, I can get whatever I want. I don't know.
But
I never heard that story before he told it, so don't see that on Wikipedia.
But I mean, I knew Terry was going to have great stories, just, you know, who he is and where he's come from. But even to hear those stories that George was telling about, you know, the old days of playing at CBGB's, I mean, that's a link that, like you said, we never got to go to CBGB's at all, and especially not in its heyday.
Right.
And for him to you know, have lived that life, those are some great stories also.
And those guys, together with a lot of years on the road and some living and some loss, yeah, now they're in a position to write and play a blues album, you know, and that's why I like this thing, because it is genuine. It's not like they said, okay, we need to do a different genre, let's stick a bunch of blues in it. No, it's something that evolved over time, and then they earned through living life and being on the road and playing this music to come up with these songs, you know. And you know, I'm not a huge country guy, but I'm digging this album a lot.
Yeah, but this is not really country. This is like, you mean when you say I'm not a country fan, I'm not a fan of like new pop country. This is old, like gristly country. This is, well, like you said, like, you know, you listen to it and you're like, yeah, I've had hard times too. Yeah, she left me and I was just the worst. It was the worst. And
it's, you know, it's blended the country white man blues with the inner city black man blues. Correct. That's basically what it is.
Correct. Yeah. But like you said, they've had enough miles under their belt now where they can write a record like this and it is genuine. They're not trying to sound like anybody else.
So catch them whenever you get a chance. And definitely, God, if I was in London this June, I would definitely be at Ronnie Scott's to go see
them. Oh, that would be awesome.
Well, that is our chat with the legendary Terry Reid and George from the Cosmic American Derelicts, two guys for whom rock and roll is more than just a passion like it is for me and Jackson. It's a way of life. And now they're not only bandmates and folks who've created great music and played together, but they're friends. You could tell that from the conversation. We could see it. You guys couldn't see it in the video that we had of them, but they're sitting there hanging out on the couch together. You know, Terry's stringing up his 12-string while George is telling a story there, you know. So great guys. With a fun, cool new album that I think everyone should check out, Bergenfield Blues. Yeah, Bergenfield Blues is already out in America, so you can go pick that up at the Cosmic American Derelicts website. You can pick it up at your record store. It will be coming out in the UK July 21st, so for our friends across the pond there, might have to wait a little bit longer there. But if you want to see Terry Reid, he is playing Ronnie Scott's in London on the 20th of June. So if you're in the Greater London area, you won't be able to see George and the rest of the Cosmic American Derelicts, but you can see Terry doing some of his great old tunes there, so don't miss out on that. Super guys. I wish them all the success with the record and in touring here 2023 and beyond. So as usual, folks, we want to know, did we get something right? Did we get something wrong? Did we miss the point? Did we leave out your favorite part? You have to let us know. You email us. It's uglyamericanwerewolf@gmail.com. Let us know the bands, the albums, the books, the concerts, the DVDs, the rock properties you want to hear us talk more about. Please go check out our store. You can get there by getting to us on our Twitter account. It's @ugly_werewolf. You can also hit up @actionjack72. You can DM us or tweet us. That's where you can go to our shop. And I think we're going to have a little discount available for Father's Day. So you might want to go ahead and check that out. You also see all of our old shows on there. We thank, as always, Pantheon Podcast. We are a proud member of Pantheon Podcast with about 100 different shows, all sorts of genres, something in there for everybody. Check out pantheonpodcast.com or check out the app at the App Store where you can hear every episode of every show on there. And of course, thank you to our sponsors, rarevinyl.com, based in the UK. Use that code UGLY, UGLY, could be capital UGLY. Use that to save 10% off all of your purchases from rarevinyl.com all around the world. And the fun's going to continue here on the Ugly American Werewolf in London. We're so psyched that we've had the opportunity to talk to so many great artists and authors and writers and folks who just love this music. And we've got a couple of great writers coming up with some books that are coming out soon, maybe already out. So you got to tune in next week. Our prog fans are definitely going to want to be tuning in. Our hard rock fans are definitely going to want to be tuning in. So until next time, to all you rock and rollers all around the world, be cool and stay safe.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.